Thank you for joining us for this episode of Take Notice, Amplifying Black Stories. I am your host, Allison Preisinger-Higgins. Take Notice, Amplifying Black Stories is a podcast exploring society, culture, and current events through conversation. We aspire to create an open, respectful, and equitable space where guests may feel free to share their truth and lived experiences. Our core values are rooted in community, connection, and personal development. Stories help us learn, relate, and grow. We are here to listen, to take notice. Thank you for being with us. I would like to show gratitude to the traditional ancestral land of the Puyallup people, past and present, on which this episode was created. I encourage listeners to research the land on which you live and are listening right now. Recognizing this is just the beginning. The more you explore, challenge, and learn, the more questions may arise, but this is how we grow and connect. On this episode of Take Notice, we welcome performing artist Michelle Nicole Matlock for a wonderful conversation on the arts, performing, clowning, and educating artists about entrepreneurship. Michelle is not only a performing artist, she is a creative coach, teacher, director, producer, and founder of Circle Up Productions, a live entertainment and performing arts education company based in Tacoma, Washington. Michelle has been a part of the entertainment industry for over 25 years and had the honor of being the first African-American person to create a main character for Cirque du Soleil. They toured with Cirque's big top show, OVO, for close to 10 years, and you get to hear about that in our conversation. Currently, Michelle is an adjunct faculty member at Del Arte International School for Physical Theater and a member of the Puget Sound Revels creative team. Recently, Michelle was clown director and consultant for Circus Bella and Emmy-nominated actress Carolyn Rattray's show, Both And, a play about laughing while black. Michelle has continuous teaching engagements and collaborations with organizations across the nation, including Clown Gym, Bindlestiff Family Circus, The Clown School, Laughter League, Circus Amok, and Tacoma Light Trail. Michelle grew up in Tacoma, Washington, studied theater for 3 years at Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington, and is a graduate of the National Shakespeare Conservatory in New York City. We had a wonderful conversation, and I thank Michelle for joining us on Take Notice. Please enjoy this conversation with Michelle Matlock. Well, Michelle, thank you for joining me on Take Notice. I'm excited to hear all about you and Circle Up Productions and your background. I'm really excited that JR connected us. So maybe just to get started, do you want to share a bit about yourself, where you're located and what you're generally up to at the moment?
Sure. Thanks for having me. Yeah, this is great. I'm excited. Well, right now I'm in New York City.
Oh, right. That's right.
I just finished doing some clown intensives here, teaching a bunch of young actors and clowns. But I'm based out of Tacoma, Washington, which is where I grew up. I'm a performing artist, teacher, director, producer, creative coach. I've been in the business of performing all my life, as far as I can remember back. And so, yeah, that's what I do. I've been lately doing a lot of teaching and directing. I recently, well, not so recently now, it's 2018 or so, I moved back to Tacoma, where I grew up, after being on tour for many years. And, you know, just trying to figure out how I can base myself out of Pacific Northwest, because I love it, and finding my way there, producing and directing, and still going out in the world and doing things, performing and teaching. So I think that's an overview of what I'm doing right now and what I do in general.
Yeah, that's great. So you're in New York. I remember you saying that. So you're there for a few weeks or to teach some classes, or what all are you doing out there?
Yeah, well, I lived here for about 15 years. My partner lives here. And so I still have community here. I love to get back to New York as much as I can. But specifically, well, I came this way because I usually spend my birthday in New York and travel around. Nice. And my birthday was last week, a couple weeks ago. And then I also usually teach a clown intensive through Clown Gym here. So it's a 3-day, like all day, every day clown workshop for actors and performers out here in New York. So I come out once a year to do that. I've done that for the past 3 years. And then connect with folks that, you know, I worked with for so many years when I lived here and see shows and, you know, just connect with the performing artists community in New York. That's, you know, it's where it's at.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah, yeah. Especially for, yeah, it seems like different hubs throughout the country for certain things. So like New York seems like, I don't know, actors, Broadway, musicals, and then, you know, then the other kind of hubs, Nashville, LA and stuff. So that's...
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Got hubs all over.
Were you based out of New York when you were doing the touring?
Yeah. So I came to New York to go to an acting conservatory out here. So 2-year conservatory. And when I graduated from there, I, you know, just sort of dove in, you know, the hustle of trying to be an actor, trying to be a performer and auditioning and being in shows and finding my niche here. And through that experience, I ended up getting kind of pulled into the circus world, the clowning world more specifically, and the original works world and solo performance world. And so I was working with companies that made up new material. I was writing my own solo show, and I was working for Big Apple Circus and Bendelstift Family Circus and Circus Amok, which are all New York City-based circuses, and then doing my show, and then over many years doing that, and then Cirque du Soleil plucked me out of New York, offering me opportunity to create a main character for one of their shows. And so I left New York and went to Montreal and did that for Cirque du Soleil. And then I was on the road for 10 years with that show and playing that character. Oh, wow. Yeah. So then after that, that's when I sort of was like, okay, what am I doing now? So that I landed back in Tacoma and was like, took my final bow with Cirque, had a wonderful 10 years on the road with them. That was an amazing moment. And then, landed back in Tacoma and was like, what am I doing here? I recognized and saw that Tacoma is kind of like trying to emerge as its own identity, you know, around having Seattle to the north and Portland to the south, and just felt like a place that would be cool to build something new. And, I love producing and directing and curating performance stuff and blending things like theater and circus and art. And so it just seemed like a place that I could sort of build something. So I just began to make connections there and started assistant directing and working with Puget Sound Revels, which is an organization that produces yearly shows celebrating the winter solstice. I created Circle Up Productions as an entity that I could operate under, that could hold all the things that I do, whether I be a producer, director, teacher. I could do it under Circle Up Productions, and it holds all of those things. And so before the pandemic, the plan was to create a sort of performance art party that would highlight and feature artists, that sort of independent artists, circus performers, clowns, singers, poets. And we were going on that path. 2020 was going to be sort of the first year that we had a full year of bookings. And of course, we know what happened.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That sort of changed, changed everything. Changed everything.
Yeah. Oh, man. I have so many questions. But to kind of jump back. So I grew up in the Northwest, too. I grew up mostly a little north of Seattle, and then in a little further north of Seattle in like Mount Lake Terrace and then Arlington. But now we're in Tacoma now. So we share the same city. So that's cool.
Nice.
And you said you grew up here. Is that right? So were you born and raised in this area in Tacoma?
So I wasn't born in Tacoma, but from the time I was 4 until I was 18, I was raised in Tacoma. Raised in, well, it was Tacoma when I was growing up. It's actually University Place is where my parents live. But when I was growing up, University Place was Tacoma.
Oh, okay. That shifted recently then, huh?
They sort of became their own city at the maybe the late 90s.
Oh, okay.
Early 2000s. But yeah, when I was a kid, Tacoma was, that's where we did all the things and went to see the theater. And that's where I was in theater as a kid. And my dad was a Navy guy. So that's where we landed. They fell in love with the area and bought a house. And my dad traveled when he would get, you know, relocated. But we stayed put. So
That's nice. Not having to hop around everywhere. Was he mostly based out of Bremerton then, or?
Yeah, Bremerton, okay. But then he was in Sandy Point, and then, you know, Portland and Long Beach, you know, so it was all up and down the coast.
Oh, okay. So your dad was in the Navy, and what did your mom do when you were growing up?
My mom she was always in sort of in administration positions. She worked for the VA hospital for some time, and then the Army Corps of Engineers for a time. But she was also really politically active. She was commissioner of parks for like 10 years. She ran for mayor. She didn't become mayor, but she ran for mayor and was like, she was really community organizing and community driven and was really involved in the school system, just because I have one younger sibling, 6 years younger than me, but we at that time, you know, we were like the only kids of color in that system, and so she really got involved just with things that came up around those issues.
Yeah,
wanted to make sure that we were well supported, and then as more kids of color came in junior high and high school. You know, she, you know, formed a whole like Black Parents Association and she was really a community driven advocate for, I'd say, students of color.
Yeah. So you had one younger sibling. And so, yeah, I guess it's a little, that sounds like it's fairly different than it is now down here, because I feel like there's more of a population of people of color down here than there is in Seattle even, or, I mean, I have no idea, like number wise or anything, but it sounds like it was different than when you were growing up. Is that right?
Yeah. And especially in that little suburb of Tacoma, which was University Place, which had its own school system, elementary schools and high school.
There were
more people of color in Tacoma proper. Like at that time, the Hilltop was where a lot of African Americans were. But it being a military town, you had diversity sort of everywhere. But in that little pocket, that little suburb, it hadn't grown to the diversity that it has today.
Right. Yeah, I think, I forgot about that piece, because that might still be a little similar to now. I'm not sure. Maybe you know more about it than me, but.
Yeah, and then there's certainly way more students. Like, my nieces and nephews went through same school district. And, lots more kids of color there. And it's considered a really good school district. So even a lot of Tacoma folks, kids of color, will get an address in UP so they can go to the, you know, go to the school system in there. It's kind of like the desired place to be. But in general, for me, as far as I can tell, after being away for so long and coming back, I mean, the city has just grown in its diversity overall, like everyone, you know, like, and University Place definitely has more African Americans, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. When you were growing up, you have a younger sibling. Are they still in this area? I guess since your nieces and nephews went to the same school, are they still out here?
Well, yeah. And that's there's nothing normal about that. Like, they went through the system. My brother wasn't around, but he has recently returned to the area. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Got it. Yeah. Nice. Did you have other family in the area when you were growing up, or is it mostly the four of you, or?
Yeah, so there was just the four of us. So I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, and both my parents were born in St. Louis, Missouri. So most of my extended family was in St. Louis. And so military families, you know, especially African-American families, like sort of band together. So we had like two or three other families that we, you know, was like our chosen families where we would have Christmases and Thanksgiving and celebrating birthdays. And my parents were godparents to a few of those families' children. And like, you know, we were this created extended family in Tacoma. But actually my blood relatives are all in St. Louis. Most of them are all in St. Louis.
That makes sense. You probably, when you bop around so much, like folks that are in the Navy or the military do, you kind of create your own communities around that. So that makes sense for sure.
Yeah.
What initially, if you remember, what initially got you interested in theater or the performing arts when you were a kid?
The memories that I have are being in a play when I was either in kindergarten or fifth or first grade. And it was Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And I was cast as Goldilocks.
Nice.
We had a joke that I was Nappy Locks, not Goldilocks.
Oh.
But yeah, and so I remember that, you know, I remember the fun that I had in that and the play that I could have and or the response from my parents about it, but it was good. And I remember after that, my mom always put me in summer programs that were theater programs. If there was a theater program, well, they didn't really have theater. I didn't really have a theater program in school until I got into junior high. And then, like, there would be children's shows that would happen in downtown Tacoma that I'd go and audition for and I would get in. Yeah, I just sort of got directed towards that way and supported in that, you know. That's how I remember, you know, sort of falling into it and being natural, it just coming really naturally to me. It wasn't hard to do that.
That's nice. You know, at such a young age, too, to just kind of, I don't know, because my brain makes things difficult. I was like, well, this is, you know, if something's easy, it's like, well, shouldn't it be harder? So that's great that that you're able to hone in on that at an early age and have it be fostered and supported by your family and the community, it sounds like, because it's great that there's so much, I've noticed so much theater and opportunities in the Tacoma area. Do you know if it's similar theaters and companies that were around when you were younger, or I imagine it's probably changed quite a bit.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, you know, I remember having this conversation with some of some folks in Tacoma, artists and performers, that there's theater, there's pockets of community theater, and I think there's also theater programs in many of the schools, and probably not as much as folks would like artists folks would like. But,
right.
But what I don't see anymore is, like, when I was a kid, there would be sort of troops or organizations that would come through Tacoma and perform at the big theaters like the Pantages. And they would hold auditions for the community to be in the show that they were bringing.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Wow.
And there were children's shows. Like, my first children's show was at the Pantages. I was 11 years old, and I got cast in that show. And it was like, we don't see those types of opportunities. At least I don't. I might not be so tapped into it right now, but, you know, maybe I just don't know. But I don't, you know, I've talked to others that were surprised to hear me say that was something that happened when I was a kid that I remember as far as theater. But I think there is a children's theater in downtown Tacoma, which seemed to be, that was very vibrant, but that hasn't really snapped back from the pandemic yet. And
that makes
sense.
I
think in general, theaters are struggling.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. I know that I'm pretty sure the Tacoma Army or the Art, not Tacoma Armory. It's the Tacoma Arts Live. Yeah. I think that's what I see a lot of. And then more recently, I became aware of Lakewood Playhouse, which is not Tacoma, I guess, but close anyway.
In the area. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Tacoma Arts Live has a lot of programming, I think, for kids.
Yeah. Yeah, seems like, and, yeah.
And the Lakewood Playhouse is known to have a children's program, too. So,
oh, cool. Nice.
They're just trying to get that back started. They've had a lot of change, and they actually just asked me to direct a show there. Potentially in March. We'll see.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be, yeah, I'm wanting to, I haven't been there yet, so I'm wanting to check it out. So I'll have to keep an eye out for that. That would be a good opportunity to go check it out. That's great.
Yeah, for sure. And that space is cool. Yeah. It's like all in the round. I don't know.
Oh, I was wondering, because some of the photos I saw online, or just on their social media, I didn't dig into it too much, but it looked like it was in the round. So that's cool. I love that. Yeah.
It's a really nice little space.
That's awesome. Very cool. Yeah, I work like right there in that little area where I teach music right there. So I pass by it and I'm like, oh.
Oh, yeah. There's some, like in the artistic Lakewood right Town Square.
Mm hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I a couple days a week at the music and arts right there. So yeah.
Teaching. Cool. Yeah. So close. But yeah, I mean, I grew up
super close
seeing that theater, but never like my parents took me to theater and like, took me to theater downtown, took me to theater in Seattle, but we never went to the Lakewood Playhouse. But I would always see it there, but I don't know if it was, I don't know what the deal was, why we never went there, because we were definitely, and that Lakewood Square has changed over the years, and that's we've been there for different things, you know, but so now they're, I think they're in the process of like, trying to rebrand themselves and reach out to more of the community. So it's going to be an exciting next couple of years for that place.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. 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 I might have to keep my eye on it. That's really great. So I saw that you went to Western, right? Up in Bellingham. And then, was that straight out of high school or?
Yep. Yeah. That was straight out of high school. I graduated and then went straight to Western to study theater.
Okay. And yeah, that was what I was going to ask, if they have a theater program. I thought they did. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. They have a theater program that was really excellent, actually, theater program. And I still give them credit for, you know, part of my education, because I got an amazing foundation there. And I connected with a community there that I'm still connected with today. And we still always find ways to try to work with each other today, many of them. But so my third year, after my third year at Western, so I was selected to be in this acting competition that was in Idaho or whatever, which seems really weird. I never understood it, the acting competition and how.
Was it Boise or?
It was like in Boise. It was like Irene Ryan's acting.
Oh, okay.
Competition is called. But at that competition, there was a school, National Shakespeare Conservatory, that was holding auditions. Mm-hmm. And so, me and the friend decided, because our next year, our fourth year, was going to be like concentrated on Shakespeare stuff. So we had Shakespeare monologues and we thought, oh, let's just go audition. And, I ended up getting accepted into the summer program.
Oh, great. So, wow.
The summer after my third year at Western, I went to the Catskills in New York and studied. It was like a two or three month program, and studied, you know, Shakespeare, and got a little taste of that type of education. And while I was in the Catskills, you know, one of the teachers there was doing a show down in New York City, and was performing in a show that she had written with another person. And so we got to take a trip down to the city to see one of our teachers perform. And, you know, we spent the night in the city and New York. I mean, it just like blew our minds. And the fact her show blew our minds. So anyway, I was like, wow, New York. And then at the end of that, I got accepted into their 2-year program, which is actually in New York City with scholarship. And it was a certificate program. It was not a degree. So that was pretty hard to convince my parents of.
Oh,
so I was just 1 year away from getting my degree, but it's really, and you know, I really felt like I needed to be there as a performing artist. Like the university was great. Professors were awesome, but unlike all the teachers at this conservatory, they're just like professors, not really doing it.
Yes.
Right? And I recognized that right away. I recognized that all these teachers were actually working and producing and directing or whatever and teaching. Mm-hmm. And that to me was seemed more valuable. And the fact that I could go to this conservatory and it was just all day, every day about performance. Mm. And I knew that's what I needed to do what I wanted to do, right? Like, this wasn't going to be a hobby for me. This is like all that I knew that I had. So my parents eventually let me go, and I think the scholarship helped
right
with the amount of money that they were helping me with, you know, being at the university.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, so 3 years at Western, 2 years, graduated from National Shakespeare Conservatory in New York.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. Such a difference from doing a program at a state university or a state college, like being able to sink into just the works that you're interested in doing with a certificate program or even just at a performing arts college, whatever one it is. That sounds like an amazing shift. And it's such a early on time being able to just say, okay, making that transition and going for it, which is amazing. And in New York, you know, it's such a like overwhelming place, but where else would you go?
Oh, yeah.
If that's what you want to do. It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I felt that too. And it was an overwhelming place.
Mm.
You know, I was like 19 years old. Like,
yeah. Right.
The conservatory went around the country and had those auditions everywhere. So the group that was in my class, we were all from all over the country.
From
everywhere. Chicago, Texas, whatever. And we're all 19 and 20, 21. And basically teachers of the program were all of the teachers at NYU's Stella Adler program. So we were basically getting that training, that Stella Adler training.
Oh, I see. Okay. Can you describe that a little bit? Because I'm sure many of our listeners may not know what that might be.
Yes. I mean, Stella was just an amazing actress that had her own technique that she wrote about and that she taught. And she was like a guru. And it was good for just a well-rounded acting and also classical acting method. But we touched on, you know, different methods, people, different gurus there too. But then we did Shakespeare, George Bernard Shaw, Molière. Like it wasn't just Shakespeare. Even though it was called National Shakespeare Conservatory.
We did study
a lot of the classics, and we had ballet and we had modern movement, and we even had clown there. And it was amazing.
That sounds amazing. Yeah. I think the first time that I realized that clowning and clown school was a thing and that people did and everything, like, was when I was in music school and somebody that I was going to school with had gone to a clown school prior to music school. And a lot of his performing chops and the technique that he knew was based on that schooling. So is that the first time that you were introduced to clowning, or had you been interested in it before? Did you get into it then, or was that later?
Yeah, no, I did not. I had never even known that it was a thing, clowning. I remember some things about that. I think they brought this clown teacher in for like 6 weeks, and we had that, and it was, I remember it being fun, and me like just naturally sort of loving to make people laugh and stuff like that. But I was there, you know, to be an actor.
Yeah.
I didn't hold clowning up as anything. And I think for many reasons, it just didn't dawn on me that that was a thing that you could like be an expert in or anything. You know,
right.
I was like, that's you know, this is great. I'm getting a well-rounded education. It's physical. Love it. But I wasn't going to join the circus. You know?
Right.
You know, that wasn't my plan at all. So I remember it, but it was like, oh, this is just part of it. It's like, I remember ballet, but I wasn't going to be a ballerina, you know?
Right.
Or a modern dancer, you know, like I was there for the well-rounded training and then the acting techniques and, you know, breathing and all that vocal. It was just another part of the thing that was really fun. I never thought that it would become such a huge part of my career.
Yeah. Who knew? That's amazing. Yeah. When did it end up sinking in that, or when did that path become open for you?
One of my college friends from Western who moved out to New York a little bit after I did, we were working together. I don't know. She just got in her brain that we needed to be clowning, that we were clowns. I don't know why. I actually have to talk to her about that and ask her, because I find myself saying this when I'm interviewed or whatever, or talking about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was resistant because, like, for me, it wasn't like, it was like nothing. It wasn't an option. It was like, what? I'm not here to be a clown. Like, what do you, why are you doing this? But I really respected her. I loved her. You know, we work well together. And so I sort of was like, okay. And she wanted to, like, make up this clown show. And so I did it because she, you know, she, this is what she was into. I wanted to work with her. We worked well together. We were silly. We were ridiculous. We laughed. We make, you know. And so we were creating this little clown show, no word show, and we couldn't afford to have rehearsals in the city. We couldn't afford rehearsal space. So we would do our rehearsals in the park, in Washington Square Park or Tompkins Square Park. And we would just, I mean, I'm sure we just looked absurd because we're just doing just physical comedy and trying to make up this little show that, you know, just making each other laugh, whatever. And a woman approached us. I guess she was entertained by what we were doing and said that she was an ex-ringling clown and that hired to create a clown program for Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines and that she needed more women in the program and that we looked like, you know, I don't know, that we were trainable or I don't know, something about us. You know, it's just like one of those rare, weird moments in New York. Like anything can happen, right?
Yeah. Wow.
And we took her card, but I mean, we were just like, oh, but you know, we're writing a show and I don't know if we have time for this or whatever. but later when me and Amy really started talking about this moment, we were like, wait a second. Did she say that they're going to train us? They're going to fly us to Miami and then we're going to be on cruise ships and all, it all was coming together. Like, wait, this is an opportunity. Ding, ding. You know, like we should do this. So we ended up doing it. We ended up getting hired and flown down and there's a bunch of ex ringling clowns that were hired. Royal Caribbean hired them for these big, humongous new ships that were coming out. Wow. And they taught us. They taught us that style of clowning and, we had to learn how to juggle and walk on stilts. And it was really that gig that made me realize that this is unlike, you know, sort of the actor in New York, circus and clowning, actually, they expect to get paid, you know, they expect to earn a living. It may not be a lot in some ways, but like the expectation is that, you know, you have a skill and you get paid to do it. Now, we fell into this very lucrative job, first job is, you know, on the job training. So I think that was when I first was like, oh, I could really lean into this and learn this skill and actually work and not have to like shuffle plates or answer phones and, you know, really do this. We did that gig with Royal Caribbean for 9 months straight. And then on and off for the like 5 years.
Oh,
and that catapulted me into another level where I was searching for these types of things. When we came back off of ships, we searched for like, what are the circuses that are in New York, you know? And we found the Bindle Stiff Family Circus, Circus Amok, which I joined. I auditioned for Circus Amok and got into Circus Amok. And Circus Amok is a outdoor, political, queer circus formed by Jennifer Miller, who's probably most famous for being the bearded lady at Coney Island for many, many years.
Oh, okay.
She's a brilliant performer. She uses circus for justice and peace. So she turns like traditional circus acts into statements about immigration and education and police brutality and all sorts of things, and travels all over the parks in the five boroughs and many of the parks are like underserved communities.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah, so that was, this is like year 2000 for me. Year 2000 is like when I was like, okay, nobody is asking me to clown for free or to clown for exposure.
Right.
Asking me to clown because of the skill and the entertainment. And then as I continued to sort of be in plays and write my own stuff, I recognized that clowning made me a better actor. Practicing and training kind of made me a better actor, just the presence and the skills that they have. So yeah, that's when I was like, okay, this is a thing. I'm going to lean in and have fun and learn the skill and be a better performer and pay my bills.
That's amazing.
In New York.
Yeah. No small feat, I imagine.
Right.
Wow. Were you, prior to the cruise ship job, that sounds like one of those moments where it's right place, right time, it was meant to happen.
Right.
Prior to that, were you having to do, while you were in school, were you working odd jobs or did you have to do any of that? Or since you were on scholarship, maybe not?
Yeah, while I was in school, I had, my first year of school, I didn't really work. My second year of school, I had to have odd jobs. I worked at, you know, Benny's Burritos and Barnes and Nobles and little things and like that. But then when I got out of school, I definitely had to, you know, figure out how to pay the rent. So I had all sorts of odd, weird jobs that I was quitting and getting fired all the time because I just wasn't, I was there to try to become a performer.
Yeah.
If anything sort of blocked that, I was like, I'm out of here. Or they're like, you're out of here, you know?
Yeah. you weren't prioritizing them enough, right?
Right, exactly. And I remember I did get a really good gig in New York working for Newsweek magazine. I was assistant to the letter. And this is like a year before or a year or two before getting the cruise ship thing. And Newsweek was really great. The letters to the editor, they were like, you can come in anytime, as long as the work is done, as long as we have the letters we need, you know, so it's really flexible
great.
And I could audition. And I just remember that being like a really helpful. But then once I did the cruise ship thing and we came back from that, it was like, I was no longer interested in having a side gig. I wanted everything to come from being a performing artist. And I just set out to plan that for myself.
Yeah.
You know, like, it took some planning and some creative ideas and some, you know, that's when I really started leaning into teaching and possibly directing and just going like, I have to go for all the things that are, you know, in line with why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when everything changed.
It's interesting. I had another guest recently, Desi DeLauro, who was also in Cirque du Soleil for, I don't know if she was in for as long as you were, but she's a singer and performer, and so she did a couple rounds with Cirque, a couple tours, I guess. And so it's interesting that this just recently talking to a couple people that were in Cirque. So was that, how did that opportunity come up for you?
So right during this sort of time period that I've been talking about, part of my plan was to have a solo show. And I wrote a solo show that sort of allowed me to mix the theater and the clowning that I was falling in love with. And I did that solo show all the time, as much as I could in New York, and sort of worked my way up as a solo performer in that world here in New York. And eventually at some point, I don't know when, and we tried to identify, but Cirque casting came to one of my shows. And after that, they invited me to audition, and I did. And Cirque is like, their auditions for performers, at least, is like this intense 2-day, it's almost like a workshop. I left that audition like a better performer.
Oh, wow.
But it's like starts with 30 people, and then they narrow it down to 15, and then 10, and then 5, and then ended with like 3 of us. And they're just like, we don't have anything for you right now, but we like you, so we're creating a file, and, you know, we'll present you to different directors and stuff. and see what happens. So 4 years later.
Oh, wow. Really?
They called me to.
Wow.
Yeah. They called me to create the role of Ladybug for their show, the new show that was coming out at that time called Ovo. And it was all a bug themed show, Brazilian themed show. Mm. And so, yeah, so that's that. That's how that happened.
Wow.
Another crazy New York thing.
Wow. And just like, you never know when that seed is going to start sprouting, as far as like when you come across different opportunities or meet different people, like you may not hear forever, but then something pops up. That's pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's really unique to Cirque.
Is it? Okay.
Because there's, I mean, like in the acting world, and I think even in most, you know, circus worlds, like they may have auditions and they pick who they want to use, and then they, and then you don't wait. It's not, you don't hear from people 4 years later, or, you know, usually.
Oh, okay.
I think it's very unusual. Yeah. Cirque really, you know, they were growing and they were getting ready to produce so many shows. And so that casting department really like found artists that they felt were really good artists and kept them on file. You know, they had a file on me.
Yeah.
I don't think most presenting organizations kind of do that.
That makes sense. Yeah.
But in general, what you're talking about, the seed planting thing is, it's real. Like, you never know when that's going to sprout and in what way. So I think you're right.
Yeah, it's wild. It sounds like you had a wonderful career with them for 10 years. Did you end up coming out here after you decided to leave Cirque, or was there something else in between?
I mean, I had really, you know, in the middle of my time with Cirque, when I was like, okay, I know this isn't going to last forever. What am I going to do? Because like sort of coming out of Cirque, what are you doing? What am I doing? Right? Like after having this such this just out of this world unique experience where you're the main character, the face of the show, traveling the world, what am I going to do? And so really for me, it was about how am I going to survive after this? So I really started like figuring out how I was going to survive financially. I started just like putting away money and figuring out what I'm going to do. I want to buy a house. I knew I couldn't do that. I couldn't afford to do it in New York.
Mm.
So and my dad wanted to be back in Tacoma. At that time, he had gone back to St. Louis for a little bit. He wanted to go back to Tacoma. So I thought, I want to be where he is. And every time I was back into Tacoma or Seattle or whatever, I loved it. It's beautiful, you know. So, okay, let's do this. Let's look for a house back in Tacoma. And I ended up buying a house in Tacoma and going and like realizing that I could kind of base myself out of wherever I wanted to at this point, sort of having this career in the circus world and feeling like I could try to build something in Tacoma that was unique too. And so, I went straight from taking my final bow to, I mean, I traveled around a bit and then I landed in Tacoma. Yeah.
Yeah. Jumping back a bit. Can you explain a little bit about both your process of putting together your solo show that you ended up touring with and what the show was just in general, or as specifically as you'd like to be?
Sure. My solo show was called The Mammy Project. And The Mammy Project was really my exploration into the stereotype icon myth of mammy in America, that history.
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered in researching it was Nancy Green, who was the first woman to be hired to play the part of Aunt Jemima.
Mm-hmm.
She was a former slave. And then after she was freed, this was a gig that she got, and she became famous for, you know, being the first one to do that. But the show really focuses around my story as trying to be an actor and sort of always getting put into that role, that mammy character, and Nancy Green's story, as much as we know of it. And Nancy Green debuted at the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago.
Mm.
And that World's Fair excluded African Americans in any other part of the fair. So Frederick Douglass, Hallie Q. Brown, Ida B. Wells, all African American activists, were fighting for inclusion in that fair at the same time that Nancy Green was debuting as Aunt Jemima and had lines and lines and lines of white people waiting for her to flip pancakes for them.
Huh. Wow.
So putting these stories together, really, you know, that was what the show was. And it really just was my way of going like, enough. You know, like, just enough of this. Like, and not only that, it's just like, this is why we are where we are. If you look at all these things, it's just like, gave me really context around like why that stereotype was still alive at the time. And it really, what propelled me, I had had this idea for a while, but really what propelled me and pushed me to go ahead and write the show was in 2002, I was, an agent called me to audition for an Aunt Jemima pancake mix commercial.
Oh.
And I was like, what? So I was like, no, no. I created that show with the help of a teacher of mine from the conservatory that ran these solo performance workshops. And I would take her workshop. At the end of the workshop, we would perform whatever we had, a few minutes. And I would do that. I did that several times until I had like, you know, about 20 minutes. Then I got another opportunity to play the show on 42nd Street at a little space. And I got to do that for several weeks, and I built it and built it up to about 50 or 60 minutes. And then I got an opportunity to play at Performance Space 122 in New York, which was really, at that time, a place that solo performers, if you could get a gig there, you were on your way. So that really, and many other things, propelled me into then taking it to, getting brought to universities and colleges all over the country. South America, Canada, and it had a great life. And like I said, this connects with the Cirque walked in and, you know, and then they sort of plucked me from out of that, you know, whole thing. I think, I was cast in Cirque show in 2008, 2009 would have been like the biggest year for the Mammy Project had I not chosen to go do Cirque.
Oh, okay. Was that a difficult decision to decide to shift gears like that, or?
No.
No?
No. Not at all. I was ready for something like Cirque. And I knew that I would be able, I knew that the Mammy Project was a show that would be relevant for a long time. I mean, that history is sort of unknown and interesting to people. My story was the only thing that would change. And in fact, that was the only thing that did change. So, sure. Last year, National Endowment of the Arts gave me a grant to revive the show. So I brought it back and took it through. This was through the Kansas City Fringe Presents. So I got the grant to bring it back, rehearse it in Tacoma. I showed it twice in Tacoma, actually, which was really awesome because I never got to bring that show home.
That's great.
And so I got to do it twice in Tacoma just with invited people. And then I did it at Casey Fringe. And it still is relevant. It still provokes a lot of emotions. And it still is still a piece that people, you know, that makes people talk. And that was what I wanted. I wanted people to have a conversation. I wanted to have diverse audiences that would like, you know, I wanted descendants of slaves and descendants of slave owners to have a conversation.
Yeah, that sounds like a really powerful show. I'm glad that you're able to revive it. Was that just for last year, or is that there plans for it to continue? Or
I wanted to continue. I just like people wanted me to do it in 2024, but I just booked all the way through 2024.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So I'm booking it for 2025, and it'll play in it'll play in Montreal. And then it'll play in Tacoma. Tacoma Urban Performing Arts Center will be hopefully in their new space. And she wants to produce it there. So,
oh, great.
Hopefully in the fall of 25.
Oh, exciting. Okay. I'll keep my eye out for that. That's exciting. Sounds like you've had the opportunity to tour around so much. What has been some of your most favorite areas around the country or the world to bring either your work or travel with Cirque or whatever other kind of groups that you've been in?
I enjoyed so much. I mean, when I was doing the MAMI project, just being in the university settings all over the country, from East Coast, Middle America, West Coast, you know, UCLA and USC and University of Pennsylvania, and like, you know, it was just great to be in those spaces and have conversations with, at that time, young people. And then with CERC, it was great to, like, I got to spend a year in Australia with that show. So just seeing something so different, so gorgeous and so beautiful, and getting to see that side of the world and travel around that area was phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. It's my favorite.
I love that. I can imagine that would be an amazing experience.
Yeah.
It sounds like the education part, like being able to travel with your show to the different universities, and then what I was seeing on your website as far as like you teach quite a bit. Is that right? So it sounds like that's a big part of your of what you have going on right now. Is that accurate?
Yeah. It's become a really big part of what I do now, which is just to pass the knowledge on, and not only the knowledge of skills in performance and clowning and acting and things like that, but really knowledge of creative business too. Like, you know I have a unique story, but there are some things that I did that all of it wasn't just by accident. You know, it's like I was prepared for some of these things.
Sure.
And I planned some of these, so to be prepared for these things. So I teach that too, you know, a lot of like what I did to be a thriving independent performing artist. That was really important to me because I just want artists to thrive, not only survive, but to thrive. And I think if more artists of all genres are thriving, you know, the world is just a better place.
Right. Yeah, definitely. What are one or two things that you, as an example of what you planned?
Yeah, well, one of those things was just deciding and planning to just commit to doing whatever it took to just work in the arts.
Yeah.
You know, and not
making the commitment.
Making that commitment and going like, well, okay, getting creative with that plan, actually planning out. Okay, what are things that I'm gonna go for? Okay, I can teach. How can I teach? Oh, okay, I can teach it, you know, I can try to teach it high schools, elementary schools. You know, how would I do it? How could I do it? What would be my plan? What would I do? You know, I could direct. How do I get into directing? How do I do that? Of course, I wanted to be performing. I wanted to be doing a solo show. Okay, I'm going to write a solo show. What do I do? How do I even make money with a solo show? Who's made money with a solo show? Oh, you know who I heard made money with a solo show? Whoopi Goldberg. What did Whoopi Goldberg do? How can I find out how she did it? How can I emulate what she did? Oh, she submitted to theaters all over Lower East Side. That's what I'm going to do too.
Smart. Just seeing what's worked and making a plan and committing. Yes.
Not being afraid to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a big hurdle, I think, is the fear. The fear, which is imposed on so many artists from so many different directions, internally, but everywhere. Yeah, culturally, internally, but I guess the internal is from the cultural expectations. And
I mean, we tell artists that, like, oh, if you're choosing to be an artist, it's your choice, and you're going to be poor.
Right. Yeah.
Literally, we basically tell artists that. Instead of saying, like, you know what? Yeah. You know what? You're going to be an artist. You know what that means? That means that you're going to be an entrepreneur.
Right.
You got to have some of those skills, too.
Yeah.
You got to have some of those skills, too, until you can afford to have someone else do it.
Right.
But that's just as important as the whatever skill or whatever your creativity is. Somehow it's bad if you're making a ton of money, now you're a sellout.
Yeah. Right. It's like you can't win either way.
I'm like, yeah, I'm a sellout. You know, I sell out every show.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah. Had I been told early on, like, all right, if you're making this choice to do music or to go into the arts, you're basically going into business for yourself. If that framework had set early on, you're an entrepreneur, solo business owner, that would have shifted so many things. And I'm, you know, I got there eventually, but man,
right.
It's like a total mind shift that has to happen that takes years. So it'd be nice if it were an earlier on thing for other artists.
That's
you know?
Imagine.
Yeah.
Imagine if alongside the acting courses or, you know, whatever, they threw a few entrepreneurial mindset courses in there. And I'm not saying that we're going to become, you know, business people, and some are more apt to it than others, but like something.
Yeah.
You know, anything that's not like just the traditional, like, okay, you're going to have headshots, you're going to send those out, you know, like for actors, you know, 98% of actors never work, you know, you know, and not everyone is apt to do it. I understand, you know, but like, you know, if you're surrounding yourself with people that are doing what you want to do and want to make a living doing it, you're building something. Like, this is what me and the woman I was telling you about that that drug me into clowning, you know, we were like, we didn't want to wait to sort of be discovered. We were just kind of just trying to discover ourselves, but we were building our community around what we wanted to do. And we were doing things that attracted, folks, just, you know, starting off real small, but like building an email list at the time. I'm showing my age. Email. I mean, I still think email is really important right now.
I agree.
And build. Yeah. So that we could, you know, let people know we're doing it next, like having fundraisers, like negotiating spaces, doing, you know, like just like building something that would allow us to, generate our own little economy when it came to what we wanted to do in terms of producing little shows here and there. Because we were building a following, we were building a community that supported us and that liked what we were doing. And so they were willing to throw us $10 or $20 or whatever. That's what I mean by building your own economy. It's like, you know, if you can get someone's email, then next thing you'll get their credit card number.
Yeah. And you have support for years to come if you're connected with them and building with them. Yeah.
That's right. And also on top of that, or next, not on top of it, but with that, really having the mindset that your ideas are your intellectual property.
Right.
Your ideas are your intellectual property. They have value. And so when you're creating, you're writing scripts, you're taking photos, you're creating music or whatever, that is your intellectual property. That is your, you know, you should expect a return on it, right? Like,
that's a good point.
You should offer it. Right. You can offer it. There's nothing wrong with offering it for a value. That's the business.
Such a mindset shift to be able to get to that point for a lot of artists, it seems like. Yeah, but that's such a good point. I like that. So I'm hopping back again with a question of when you're bringing your solo show around the country to different universities and different spaces, and you talked about one of the goals of the show was to encourage conversation around these issues that you bring up in the show. What are some of the conversations that ended up coming out of that you are aware of? I'm sure there's a lot of like folks driving home afterwards or whatever that you may not know about, but as far as you know, what are some of the conversations that came through for the audience or the impact that show made?
Some of the most significant conversations that were had were, and this is before, this is not this past year, but this is like back in the early 2000s.
Okay.
And so we were in a different place, right? Like we hadn't had pandemic or George Floyd happen yet, right? Like, But people just like, there wasn't this like political correctness thing going on either. People were really honest. And what we would probably consider offensive now. That's the difference between now and then that I noticed in the talkbacks is that people are more reserved But what was coming out was just like an acknowledgement of sort of oblivious from white people being oblivious to that this was painful for African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of admitting their love for that image and that stereotype and wondering why, you know, now just questioning things. Confirmation from a lot of African Americans that this, you know, that they identified with this sort of stereotype and all stereotypes and how it has affected their lives. Because at that time, the discussion was just about how these stereotypes that were sort of entertainment actually for African Americans gets brought into your real life, your real jobs.
Mm-hmm.
It's really frustrating. And I think it was the first time, I think I was in Boston, the first time that I heard, and remember this is like 2004 or something, a white lady stand up and say, like, white people need to start talking to other white people.
Mm.
Right? And I just remember being blown away by that. I was like, yes, that is the right answer. I'm done. I'm done talking to white people about this.
Yeah. Right. Yes. That's a great point, because what came up so much from, well, in recent years anyway, is that, you know, like, there's so much burden put on people of color to explain things and to try to educate,
right,
versus like, there's like a wealth of resources for anybody to look into and not have to ask the question of their friend or someone they hardly know who's a person of color to explain all of history and all of the issues and you know, just become exhausted every time that comes up. Yeah. And so, in addition to that, the woman's point, at least how I take it, is like, it's everybody's issue. It's not just a African American issue or people of color issue. It's everybody's. It affects everybody. So,
right.
and we got to take some responsibility and sort it out a little bit.
That's right.
Amongst That's right. each other. Right.
Yeah. And I didn't see that. So I heard that back in early 2000, and I was blown away by it. Like, yeah, that's exactly it. But I didn't see it really happening until that, what I call the mini awakening we had after George Floyd was murdered in the summer of 2020. Yeah. When that True. Sort of woke up some folks, specifically white folks, to some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard this idea more and more and more of white people talking to white people and understanding that more and more and more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems as though it's, at least from where I'm sitting, it seems as if it's faded a bit since that, which I guess that's how things go in a way, but yeah, it definitely has made a massive impact and was an awakening for many people and like in an interesting way. I mean, me included for sure. So.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think we shifted in some things, and I think that, you know, mm-hmm. it's a lot too. It's a lot all at once, you know, even though yeah. like, you know, many True. People of color or whatever, it's just like, oh my God, it's a lot. What do you mean? It's a lot. My whole life is a lot. But,
right,
you know, like,
right.
But, you know, what I'm really proud, you know, like, I work for a lot of organizations that are just continuing the work. Swear to God, it's going to be the circus that changes the world, because several of the circus organizations that I work for, they're still investing in diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and trainings and continued education. They really just sort of recognizing that it isn't a one-off thing. It's like forever.
Yes. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I will say that I see that a lot of organizations are continuing for sure. That is a good point. It's not like they're like, oh, well, we did our part and let's move on or something, you know? So I think the shift has been in recognizing that it's an important issue to keep in the forefront for their businesses and
right.
for their employees and their clients, whoever they're trying to serve. And yeah. What are you most excited about coming up this year?
I just definitely want to get in here that I been working for Puget Sound Revels in Tacoma for the past 4 years, assistant directing their shows in preparation to actually direct the full show. And that will happen this year, 2024. And I'm writing and directing the show for them this year. And I'm really excited about that. Puget Sound Revels is this wild organization that does these winter solstice celebrations at the Rialto every year. And it is an interesting organization. I mean, predominantly white organization that is trying to expand the stories that they tell. So the founder reached out to me in 2019 and invited me to come be a part of it to, you know, just help do that. So I'm excited that it's finally happening. And I'm writing a show about Seneca Village, which was in Central Park before it was Central Park. It was like this village that was owned by all African Americans.
Oh, okay.
And so anyway, we're going to do a lot of singing and dancing and tell a little bit of that story.
That's interesting. Yeah. So preparing for that for the winter solstice this year.
That's right. I've been super excited about this whole year just because it's the first time besides the year 2020, but it never got fulfilled, that I've been booked out the whole year, right? Like coming here and teaching in New York was fantastic. Always great energy and to connect with this community. I'm getting ready to go to that conference for the Puget Sound Revels in Tacoma that's happening in Arizona. And I get to talk to them about their ideas in the new show. And then I go to San Francisco and I get to perform at the Circus Center in a crazy clown show that I'm just going to make up with several other clowns. And then I go to Atlanta and teach clown there for hospital clowning.
Oh, wow.
And then what do I do? Oh, then I come back and direct at the Lakewood Playhouse. Yeah. Oh, then I go teach it. Before Lakewood Playhouse, I teach down at Del Arte, solo performance workshop for 3 weeks. That's in Northern California, Del Arte Physical Theater School. Then I come direct the show back in Tacoma, or on Lakewood. Yeah, then I'm back at Del Arte to teach clown. And then I'm back in Tacoma, like, getting ready for the Puget Sound Revels Winter Solstice show. And I direct the Tacoma Light Trail that happens in downtown Tacoma. So I curate and produce the New Year's Eve celebration that happens December 31st that kicks off the Tacoma Light Trail. So I'm excited for this whole year. Get to do so many cool things.
It sounds like it. That's amazing. I was going to ask you about that because JR mentioned the Tacoma Light Trail after I had already gone. And I believe my husband and I saw you. Were you emceeing this last year?
Yes, I was emceeing. Was that you?
Yes, we saw you.
That was cool. I'm so glad that you made it.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was so lovely. It felt like a wonderful small community of, you know, small town kind of thing in like this city. I mean, so it was wonderful. And we enjoyed the art and just wandering around. I think we wandered for, I don't even know how long, but just up and down that main street and then a little more. And it's just such a nice way to spend New Year's Eve for sure. So I'm super cool. Yeah.
That is really cool. I'm glad that you got to experience that. So it was my first year directing that trail. So it was a little smaller than it usually is just because we have a whole new team. And we hope to build it back up to how the founder envisioned it.
Yeah.
And we learned a lot. So
that's awesome. Yeah. I have nothing to compare it to. It's the first time I'd gone. So I thought it was wonderful. Yeah. But yeah, that's always how events go, right? It's like, it's always, all right, what's for next time? Yeah. what are we going to do differently or better or whatever? Or we're never going to do that thing again. So thank you, Michelle, for joining me on Take Notice and sharing your stories and taking the time. I know I took more of your time than I said I would, and I appreciate you hanging out.
It's all good. No, it was a great conversation. Thank you for having this podcast. I can't wait to listen to more of it and see who you're interviewing and stuff. It's great. It sounds like it's super cool.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I appreciate you coming on the show and being a part of it. Enjoy your travels. I'm so excited.
Thank you.
For you. Yeah.
Right on.
Thank you for joining us for Take Notice, Amplifying Black Stories. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to share it with someone you know. Connect with us on social media. We would love to hear from you. We are at Take Notice Podcast. You can also find us at takenoticepodcast.org. Reviews help us reach more listeners, so please rate and review on your favorite podcast app. Take Notice, Amplifying Black Stories is produced, hosted, and edited by Allison Preisinger Higgins. Music by Version Big 5 featuring Darius Higgins. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for taking notice.